PRN.
My name is Mark Farrell. The show is Insight. Thanks so much for joining me, wherever you are. Kind of an exciting day. I guess ambivalent for some people in New York City today. Opening to the families of the victims of 9/11 is the National September 11th Memorial Museum in the year 2014. Took some doing, huh? Yeah, not something that actually came about too quickly. I'm sure it's going to be very heart-wrenching, maybe reassuring, comforting to some people. But nonetheless, I'm happy that it's actually completed, and the door is opening today, again, for the victims, family victims of what took place. All right, we're going to have some fun today, as we always do every Thursday. You know, it drives me crazy, because you know what? When you get a good song in your head, it's great. But this morning, I woke up with Chris Martin, Coldplay's new single, Magic. And, you know, I like the song, but it's not one of the songs that I want just reverberating in my head incessantly 24/7. And I blame this on two things. Number one, the incredible high rotation of radio. And that's why you're listening to internet radio, because, you know, we are different here, especially at PRN, Progressive Radio Network. And secondly, I blame my wife, because she will not stop singing it. And that's case in point, more credence to point number one, because she hears it all the time on radio. And actually, the new album, Ghost Stories, drops tomorrow, and it's got some great reviews. So if you're a fan of Coldplay, it sounds like it's a new stripped-down album. And speaking of stripping down, I'm sure this is no news for all you guys. You know, Chris Martin and Gwyneth Paltrow, present wife, separated, soon-to-be ex-wife. It looks like he is really hurting. Did you see him 2 weeks ago on SNL? He was singing Magic and some other tunes, and he just looked like, first of all, his eyes were shut. And I get that, you know, because musicians really kind of get into the song, the vibe. But it seemed like he was singing from the heart, and he almost couldn't look at the crowd, the audience, because I felt like he was going to just wallow in this sea of misery. I felt so bad for the guy. Plus, he looks heavier. I mean, this guy looks like, you know, a walking, talking, living leprechaun normally. And not that he's heavy by any stretch of the imagination. But he's put on weight, so you know the guy's hurting. So you feel bad for the guy. He got good reviews the other night at the Beacon Theater when they were there. And I would have loved to have seen him. And my wife keeps reminding me, like, so you couldn't get tickets because... And I thought you had some pull in the music industry, Mark. I'm like, okay, leave me alone. But Chris was pretty cool. He asked that everyone at one point put their camera phones away and not record one of the tunes so that it didn't leak onto YouTube. Yeah, fat chance there, Chris. And so it could be just a moment shared between the artist and a fan. How nice. Well, that didn't really happen. But of course, in a situation like this, you know, you feel bad for the kids. You know, I feel bad for the kids, number one, first of all, when I found out their names. I mean, Apple? Really? And Moses? Come on, Apple you can get away with, you know, sweet girl. But Moses, man, what are you going to do? And actually, I didn't realize that, but he initially, Chris, wrote that for his wife initially, before they were married. What I didn't know was Gwyneth, Mrs. Personality. And I only say this because of what, of course, we all read in the trades and here in the media. Sounds like she's a handful. And not too many people dispute that, so maybe that is the case. But I didn't realize that she was engaged to Brad Pitt. Wow. Damn. I wouldn't have put the two of them together. Also dated Ben Affleck. Again, I would never pair the two of them together. But actually, they were in a movie together. Weren't they in a movie... about, I forget the name of it, Ben Affleck was on an airplane and, or actually gave his ticket to Gwyneth's husband in the movie, and he actually perished. And it was him all trying to make justice or feel good about the fact that he switched his seats. Anyway, so that's Coldplay for you, and that's why I have the song Magic in my head in a long roundabout way. But it kind of makes me think about, like, what have I done? Like at the end of a breakup or during a breakup or a post-breakup to kind of, you know, survive. You know, one thing I certainly did was I went out and tried to kind of bed as many women as possible. And that was always kind of my M.O. And I guess it was a little bit heightened during the separation stage, and I also had a lot of fun doing it. But I realized certainly that was me just not really kind of paying attention to my sorrow and possibly depression, etc. And speaking of depression, it is National Mental Health Awareness Month. No, it's not like Mardi Gras where we're going to party our ass off for 30 days, but that would be kind of cool. But during a time like this, Mental Health Awareness Month is a pivotal month because, you know, it affects so many people. It affects every one of us on earth, whether you realize it or not. You know, it could be a positive thing. Mental health is not always negative. That's the thing that really kind of gets under my skin sometimes. People always equate mental health as something that is wrong with somebody, something that they can't shake. Maybe that they are just depressed or they have schizophrenia and it's their fault and they just can't get rid of it. But mental health is far from that. I mean, there's so many other variables, and that's why I am not going to talk about this like I know it, because there are no initials after Mark Farrell's name, except a few expletives probably that people like to use. But that's why I invited Dr. Michael Friedman. He's a clinical psychologist, member of the Medical Advisory Board at EHE International, and that's a international healthcare company, and it gives me great pleasure to welcome, I will call him Dr. Mike, to Insight. Hey, Dr. Mike, how are you?
Hi, Mark. Thanks for having me on the show.
How are you feeling today, my friend?
I'm doing well. I just want you to know that one of the biggest things I deal with in my practice is people who have trouble getting Coldplay songs out of their head. So, and even more of a specialty is people who are husbands whose wives sing Coldplay. So with you, man. You know, I understand where you're coming from here.
Now, am I going to get a remedy, or do I have to be on the leather couch?
I think we would need to talk about it more. This is not simple. This is not easy, and it's not something we're going to deal with.
This sounds like a 12-step process, my friend.
Absolutely.
So, of course, you know, the stigma of mental health has been widespread and still rampant. In your years of practice, I imagine you've been in the field for 15, 20 years, correct?
That's about that right, yeah.
Have you seen a progress? I certainly have in the last, my brother took his life 21 years ago.
I'm sorry about
that. Thank you. I've seen a change. Certainly I've grown to know a gargantuan amount of information about mental health in those 21 years, but I see a sea of change, certainly in political arena. But give me your input in terms of a layman's perspective and also a clinician's perspective.
I definitely think that it's still a terrible problem. I mean, I think that if you look at what experts say about barriers to treatment, the stigma of mental health issues is still, when we say stigma, what we're really talking about is prejudice and discrimination against people with mental health issues, is probably one of the biggest barriers to treatment. So it's still probably the worst problem on that front, but it was so much worse, you know, like you said, 20 years ago. I think that with more and more research that shows that there are biological causes, you know, people used to always say that it was something deeply rooted in someone's unconscious, that there was something quote unquote crazy about them. But when people start to see that mental health issues have the same biological causes in many ways as physical health issues, I think people are starting to understand a little bit more and starting to destigmatize.
Who do you think are the most responsible for kind of fueling a stigma? Same people who are disclaiming global warming?
Well, it's, you know, in a lot of ways, there's no one particular person who will have a prejudice or discrimination against people with mental health issues, because you can come at it from so many places. A lot of times it's just, you know, we grow up with people saying things, you know, kids say things like crazy right from as soon as they can talk, or weird. And, you know, you see in the media every time that there's a violent act, people start talking about the mental health issues that are associated with that person. And certainly there are some people with mental health issues that commit violence, but that doesn't mean that every single person who has a mental health issue is violent. And so I think part of the issue is it's so embedded in our culture to try to identify and figure out and in some ways isolate people with mental health issues, that it's pervasive, I think, through everyone.
Now, I was kind of probably targeting more like platforms like the media, education, politics, politicians. I mean, it seems that the White House is doing much more in the last two administrations than the multiple administrations in terms of pushing the important significance of mental health.
Yeah, I think that one of the things that, you know, when you ask, like, who's the perpetrators of this, the problem is as much what they call social distancing, which is it's not so much that people will come out publicly and say negative things about people with mental health issues. It's more that people will stay away from people with mental health issues at times. And you see this manifesting in all areas. Interpersonally, sometimes people will keep their distance in one way or another based on some of the fears that they've developed over the course of their life. You know, people have not treated mental health as serious of a problem as physical health. If you look at the budgets over the years and you look at insurance, you know, how insurance handles both. But now they're saying, the World Health Organization is saying that by 2030, you know, mental health issues are going to be probably just as, I mean, they're already the high, you know, depression is probably, and mental health issues is one of the biggest causes of disability already. And so I think that people are starting to see that, look, this is serious. So it's not so much that people say negative things, it's that they kind of ignore or move away from it. And that's where the real problems wind up starting.
So do you think it falls on the shoulders or a responsible way would be for school systems, and I know some of this is in place already. School systems, it could be as early as fifth grade up through high school, even college level, have more in place about mental health, positive mental health, because I'm a speaker and I speak at different high schools and colleges throughout the nation. That's one of the things I speak about, mental illness, any negative connotations, and my experience with my brother and what I've gone through personally with anxiety, panic attacks, and depression. And so the dialogue, once you open it, so much more candor happens. People open up and they, I think they feel so much more included versus, you know, ostracized, because they do feel like they have to keep this great, huge, gargantuan secret to themselves. So do you think the dialogue would be something of a positive?
Definitely. I mean, I think that one of the biggest things that I'll contend with when I'm working with people is that people are trying so desperately to avoid anything in their own experience that feels like it's quote-unquote unhealthy or it's crazy. Or it's disordered. You know, if people start to feel depressed, they want to avoid the depression, if they feel anxious, if they have thoughts that are unwanted. And so what we know from research is that kind of emotional avoidance or thought suppression actually makes the problem so much worse. And so just that alone, people, you know, hearing from other people, look, I'm not the only person who's woken up, you know, feeling really alone, feeling really empty. I'm not the only person who experiences panic attacks. That, you know, process alone will help people to be able to say, oh, okay, I don't need to be so afraid of this. I can look at it. It doesn't mean that it's necessarily pleasant all the time, but there's a big difference between saying, look, this is something that's unpleasant that I have to contend with, and trying to push something completely out of experience.
Now, when you say deny, Dr. Mike, you mean they're actually just not listening to their bodies?
No. It's not so much, when the term denial usually is kind of more of an old school psychoanalytic term.
Oh, sure,
I think that people, you know, that would happen in theory on a more unconscious level. Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, as an example, let's take panic attacks. You know, I work with so many people that don't recognize that millions of people suffer from panic attacks. They think literally they're the only person who's ever ridden on a train before and gotten nervous, you know, or been on a subway and thought that, oh, the subway's going to stop and I'm going to be trapped. And that leads them to a whole series of negative self-talk that mm-hmm. makes the problem that much worse. And what happens is that if they realize that other people, you know, struggle with the same issue, it's not that unusual. And that in some ways it actually makes sense. I mean, who wants to be stuck underground in a train? Then all of a sudden it's like, okay, this is something that I get. This is something that I understand. And it's something that I can work on. I can learn how to tolerate. I learn how to talk to myself differently. And so that's, you know, if you can go through that process, that's where problems start to get better as opposed to worse.
I have been there in so many ways. The example you mentioned on a train when I started having panic attacks, and when I first realized that, you know, something's going wrong, it was after my brother died about a year or so ago, 20 years ago, and I was so petrified, Dr. Mike. I was extremely frightened, and every ounce of my body, every cell thought I was going crazy. And I said, I have to tell somebody. And I was so afraid to tell my family because they're going to think, oh, geez, maybe Mark is going to take his life. And that was the farthest thing from the truth. You just realize that I need to get help. And that's what I did. And I mean, that's what I implore people to do who've ever had that, because you feel like your life is truly being threatened.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, like, as you're talking about a perfect example. Unfortunately, a lot of people struggle with, you have this major life event, this tremendous tragedy. It would almost be abnormal in some ways if you weren't more anxious, more stressed, more kind of worried and ruminated, you know, ruminating about your own life, just the sadness of what happened, you know, what does it all mean? And, you know, you're walking around with that tension, and if that gets placed somewhere, you know, maybe you would have been a little bit afraid on a subway, but now, you know, you're kind of walking around with all this, you're going to be a lot afraid. And in a situation like that, for someone, you know, like what you were struggling with, to be able to say, all right, I mean, this isn't good, but I get it. Like, I'm going through a lot right now. But, you know, the fact that, you know, you're a smart guy, you're on the radio, you talk about this stuff, but it's still scary to, you know, talk to people about it. It's still scary to talk to your family about it, because no one wants to be that person who panics or who people think is quote-unquote crazy.
And or make other people panic in your family or immediate circle.
Right. And that's a realistic fear. I mean, one of the things that we see with depression is that depression in some ways can be a little bit contagious. So in other words, if you're, you know, these studies of college roommates show that if one roommate is depressed, the other one is more at risk for depression. And that, you know, happens through a series of factors that can be prevented. But, you know, people do, when they're around anxious people, they're around depressed people, they get worried that they're going to, you know, quote unquote, catch it in some ways, you know, because they're equally afraid of having it. And that's another place where if people weren't so afraid of the issue, that process wouldn't happen as much. You know, this person's anxious. It doesn't mean that I'm going to get that way. And it doesn't even mean it's so bad if I do.
It's almost like you're a victim of your own environment.
Yeah, in some ways.
Wow, if you can't extricate yourself, then you could possibly be kind of doomed there. But knowing it, first of all, knowing and understanding is a first step in any problem. Obviously, acknowledging and or realizing it is key. What about teenagers? I mean, obviously, in the last decade, we're going to touch upon, I mean, this is probably out of your purview. I'm not sure if you're a parent, Dr. Mike, but when you hear about all these stories, is actually... you can't even make these up, these incidents that are happening nationally and internationally at high schools and colleges and obviously in the workplace. But more importantly, teenagers, do you think, obviously, with social media, the platform, the stresses of being an adolescent, can you wrap your hand around, your brain around why this has increased so much?
Why the bullying are you talking about?
Well, there's a lot there, and I'm sorry to be unfair to you.
There's a lot to talk about.
There is. Let's go more about depression for adolescents and teenagers.
I am a parent, and, you know, I think that it's, you know, there's a lot that's going on in adolescence. I mean, you know, you're talking about all these, you know, physical changes that are going on, all these hormones. Like, you haven't, you know, figured out your place in the world. Everything's very tenuous. You know, to be honest, it's kind of like a perfect storm for having mental health issues. And, you know, what, as a parent, you know, one of the things that's just so tough is that, you know, trying to both kind of reassure the child that things are okay, but a lot of that is really like kind of acknowledging that you get that you're not feeling okay at that time. You know what I mean? Like, you don't know where you're going to end up in the world. You don't know how you're going to do in school. You don't have, you know, your career set. You don't necessarily have a partner. You know, you don't even, you know, all the infighting that happens with friends, you know, and all the nasty stuff, like you were saying, that happens on social media. I think for parents, at least what I try to do, even though my kids are younger, is kind of validate and say, like, I get it. You know, I've even been through that. But that doesn't take away from the fact that it's really hard. You know,
sure.
I think that what sometimes people want to do is they want to say, oh, it's okay, it's okay. And it's, you know, it's not okay a lot of the times. And just knowing that, I hate to say it this way, but it's okay for it not to be okay as far as how it feels, but you can still look for behavioral solutions out of it, I think is one of the key messages to try to get to teens.
I definitely concur, Dr. Mike, because I have almost a five-year-old, and I say that's good that you're feeling that way. You may not want to feel that particular feeling, but it's good, and it shows that maybe you're sensitive, you're compassionate, or whatever the case may be. So that allows them to be like, okay, it's all right that I'm feeling this way. And maybe, again, we don't want to feel that way, but versus like, don't cry, don't worry, it's going to be okay.
No, that's what you're saying is exactly spot on. And I say that to the people I work with all the time. Like, you know, you want to have, you know, like a lot of times our being happy is based on sort of ignorance to certain things that are going on. And people who are quote unquote sensitive are just that, like they're picking up things, you know, in the world, and they're picking up on, and you want that skill. You don't want to not have that skill. You just want to figure out, you know, how to point it in the right direction. And that's hard. But I think what you're saying is exactly right. Like, you know, you want a kid who's perceiving all these different things that are going
Absolutely.
On. You know, it's a great trait to have as you get older.
And to develop that dialogue at such a young age. So obviously you want that dialogue to grow, and you're going to go in ebbs and flows where your child, if you have a child, may or may not confide in you and or, you know, tell you exactly what they're feeling. But at least, you know, you plant that seed very young. So you have an understanding. At least you can observe when they're maybe not even articulating it, but you can physically observe when they're not happy or experiencing something.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, you know, it's good to see that more people, and I'm sure as a clinician, you're probably happy about this as well, that people in the limelight, because there are no exceptions to mental health issues, depression, suicide, you name it. Obviously, there's countless people who are celebrities and luminaries that have taken their lives. But when you see someone like Catherine Zeta-Jones, Jim Carrey, a whole host of people that put it out there, share it to the world that, yes, they do too. I mean, money doesn't take away the fact that you can be depressed or have bipolar disorder, whatever the condition can be. So I think that something like that really opens doors to understanding that, you know what, it can happen to anybody.
Yeah, I think that what you're talking about, again, you talk about something like bipolar disorder. I mean, this is a highly biological, you know, condition that, you know, most people are born with to a certain extent. And then depending on certain stressors, it's more likely to come out. And yeah, you see, you know, people who are in the media who, you know, Hollywood is in some ways created to, you know, give the image of the lives that the rest of us don't have. And so, you know, there's that sense that everything's perfect. And when you hear someone being willing to come out and say, look, I have this issue too, I mean, you know, that reaches millions and millions of people in a 30-second, you know, split, and that can do a lot in order to make people feel like, oh, you know, at least I know there's one other person out there. And sometimes that's the only person they know of. You know, someone growing up, you know, they don't necessarily know anybody else who has bipolar disorder. You know, this is something that they may have been diagnosed with. They may not even know what the term is. They just know the experiences that they go through. And so it's wildly important, you know, when people come out and are willing to take that step.
Dr. Mike Friedman's on the phone today. He's on Insight right now in honor of Mental Health Awareness Month. My name is Mark Crowley. His show is Insight on PRN.FM, 888-874-4888. Love to hear your calls, questions, insights, 888-874-4888. You know what really irks me? When someone of the Britney Spears or Mariah Carey caliber, and believe me, I'm not faulting them for having any issues, but it's, I guess, the way they act out in public because they don't know how when they undergo or suffer from depression or whatever. I don't know what their diagnosis was, but it kind of feeds the stigma about people being a little bit crazy and out there. And I really dislike that.
Well, I kind of stay away from diagnosing celebrities. I think one of the, you know, the biggest mistakes that we make is when we see somebody, you know, the way that I say it with practitioners is that, you know, if you haven't met with someone, you really have no idea what they're going through.
Absolutely,
and if you've met
sure.
with them, you really can't talk about it at all. And so, you know, when you see somebody who's behaving in a certain way, the way that I always look at it is just kind of look at the behavior, like does somebody like the behavior or not? You know, and I also think to a certain extent, while, you know, everybody's got, you know, it's kind of what you were saying before with celebrities talking about mental health issues. You know, people at all levels have all different kinds of stressors. And so I try to, you know, stay away from judging, especially if I don't know somebody.
pardon me. We mentioned you mentioned before about stressors, and a lot of times people mask. And I was a great masker myself for years. So when the anxiety would come on, I didn't know what it was, what I was feeling. So my alcohol level intake would go up. A good 4 or 5 days a week, I would have a couple beverages and or more. I would be more into sports because I felt a good release. So again, I would listen to my body to a certain extent, but take my own advice and or a form of medicating and or ignoring and going back to the word denial. There are so many different forms of that. Substance abuse, maybe it's sex. I mean, you've heard and read, I'm sure, and probably written about how people sometimes do anything. Again, you mentioned this earlier, to admit and or face their own problems.
Yeah, I mean, the way that I talk about it with substance use is if you think about how muscle develops, you tear the muscle down and you build it back up again, and that's how muscle develops. When you're just going about in your regular day and you're not using, you're constantly facing all of these negative emotions, anxiety, emptiness, sadness, anger, and you're essentially kind of tearing down and building back up emotional muscle at all times. And what happens when you're using is that it effectively stops this process. Whereby, even if it's just, let's say, some people say, like, after work, I have a few drinks. Well, there's all that time that you would be learning how to tolerate all of the negative feelings that you might have, like, being bored, et cetera, that you're not doing then. And then all of a sudden, it's sort of like, well, okay, I didn't get that muscle development, and now I'm facing the exact same thing the next day. It makes the idea of drinking just seem a little bit more appealing. It's like, I don't want to deal with having to sit around doing nothing. I don't want to, my negative thoughts or my anxiety. And so that's the trap with people when they drink or, if they smoke pot, is that you go kind of a long period of time without having all those opportunities to build up that emotional and distress tolerance.
And a common retort is, well, it's a great escape.
It is a great escape, and I think that, you never want to judge a behavior in, kind of all or none. They're for some people, it's a great escape, but what happens, is that if you're doing it all the time, again, if you think about someone else who is not doing those things, like, they're building up all of that distress tolerance, all of that ability to handle those things, whereas you're not. And so, you think about, like, how long some people drink or smoke pot. You could be doing it for 20 years when you're just into young adulthood, and that's a lot of repetition. That's a lot of practice of not tolerating something. And I see it all the time in my practice. It just becomes too much, and people really just don't want to give up their substance, and they almost kind of have an overt conversation with themselves where they say,
I got really good at that over the years.
Say that again?
I'm sorry. I got really good about practicing over the years.
Yeah, no, it's so easy to fall into because, these are for a lot of, they're innocuous habits to a certain extent, especially, especially smoking pot is one of, the problem with smoking pot is that there's no direct problem with smoking pot. Like, nothing really bad happens. For a lot of people, but what winds up, certainly there are people for whom bad things happen, but for a lot of people, they just go day by day and, they get up the next morning and they go to work and then they start smoking when they get home. And it's so insidious in that way that you just kind of wake up, and the idea of having to deal with panic or deal with anxiety or stress just is much harder.
And soon to be possibly more ubiquitous.
Yeah,
I
think that the way to handle it is not, for me, from my perspective, is not to make it illegal. I think that, it still is something that I believe it should be legalized, but it doesn't mean that I'm not going to go out there and explain how using it to excess is problematic.
Absolutely. Dr. Mike, do you have a few more minutes?
Absolutely.
Great. When we come back on PRN.FM, we're going to talk to Dr. Mike about the different types of therapy right after this on PRN.FM. Hey, Thursday in New York City. Feels good. I love Thursdays. You know why? So much is still possible. Got the weekend on tap, lots of plans, or maybe none. Some of the best weekends I've ever had is when I've had no plans. How about you? Love to hear your feedback today. 888-874-4888. The show is Insight. My name is Mark Farrell. Thanks so much for joining me this Thursday and every Thursday from 11 to noon. Coming up at noon is Mr. Gary Null. Don't miss his show. And we're talking about Mental Health Awareness Month. On the phone with me is Dr. Michael Friedman. He's a clinical psychologist, a good guy, and knows how to rid you of the song Magic by Coldplay if it's ruminating around in your head. Right, Mike?
Absolutely.
We're talking about the different types of therapy. Now, as far as I know, I've received actually two types of therapy. Freudian therapy, where, and I'm going to let you explain that, but cognitive therapy is more, I believe, of the immediate. Like, if I'm having panic attacks, okay, how do we address that? How do we kind of break down the issues and or maybe barriers and or sources that are causing that? Compare and contrast the two types of therapy and how people should or could possibly decide which is right for them.
So I think the best way of comparing them is to start with what we know about what works with therapy. And all the evidence suggests that there are four key factors in any therapy. One is that there's a clearly defined problem. So when you go into therapy, even if right away you don't know exactly what you want to work on, at some point you're able to say, okay, I'm depressed, I have panic, I just don't, you know, I don't feel right. Or, you know, even if it's a little bit vague, you say, okay, here we know what's going on. The second thing is having some kind of model between the, what do you want to call, patient or a client and the therapist to say, okay, here's what we think is happening. So, and for there to be agreement on that. So in other words, like if we say, okay, this is something that happened in your past, this is just something in your behavior, something in your thinking, whatever it is, to have a very clear model. And then also the third thing is to have an agreement on, here's what we need to do together in order for you to get better. These are the steps. And then finally, how are we going to measure that outcome? If you have those four aspects of a therapy, in some ways, the evidence suggests that it doesn't matter what kind of therapy you use, that the therapy will generally work better.
Do clinicians typically practice one or the other?
Sometimes. I think that it's, you know, when I went to grad school, it was really when cognitive behavioral therapy had started to take hold more. So my program had originally been more psychoanalytic, psychodynamic, and then it turned more cognitive behavioral. And so I wound up getting trained in both to a certain extent. But I think now it's probably more common that people get one or the other.
And I find that in terms of stigma, going back to stigma, that people usually make fun of the Freudian type of therapy because, you know, they delve into your childhood. And there could be a lot of relevancy to that, certainly. But I believe my understanding, certainly with cognitive, it's more like the present right now. How do we fix it so you can get by?
Yeah, and I think I generally tend to focus more on that kind of therapy. You know, what I always like to start with is, what are, you know, I find just on a personal level, when I work with people, that you first want to start with basic health behaviors. I always look at sleep, eating, exercise, and substance use. You know, so I'll get people who are coming to me, they're not sleeping well, they're not eating healthy, they're not exercising, and they're drinking 8 cups of coffee a day, and then they're coming to me and asking me, why is it that they're anxious, and, you know, did something happen, is there a conflict, you know, and I'd say, well, before we can know anything, let's just kind of clean you up here a little bit. Like, let's get you having a healthy lifestyle. And I'll tell you, a lot of people, I think, get better just from that. And then what we tend to go with then is like, okay, well, are you behaviorally activated? You know, like, are you doing, you know, things that make you enjoy your life? Are you doing things that make you feel a sense of achievement? Are you connecting with people in a way that you want? And you kind of break that out, and then after that, for me, then I start to talk to people about, you know, okay, so now what are the coping strategies that you might need in order to deal with your problems in the here and now? And what can we see as these kind of themes that matter to you? You know, there's a study that just came out that said having a sense of purpose makes you live longer. And so I always like people to kind of be able to identify. It's like, what are the things that matter to you? You know, why are you getting up in the morning?
Sure, sure. Look at people who retire. And don't do anything.
That's a great example. That's a great example. I mean, you know, I'll have people who I work with who, you know, are incredibly successful in every area of their life. And, you know, in a lot of cases, that leads them to be able to retire at a relatively young age. And, you know, in some cases, even though the cause of the retirement is a good one, it'll take a while before people get their footing because, you know, you don't plan for, you know, being like, well, so what do I do now? Like, what's my point now?
What's the phrase you use, Mike? Behaviorally
Oh, activated?
Activated. I want a t-shirt that says, I am behaviorally activated. That's a great term.
I think that t-shirt would do very well. I think you should get a quarter every time someone says it.
Absolutely, and absolutely. I'll sing someone a Coldplay song as well. Now, I'm sitting here in the last day or so thinking about, you know, Mental Health Awareness Month, and I think about the stigma and what could possibly bother people. And certainly people's backgrounds of where they're from, their family origins, their roots, the religious beliefs, et cetera. So many different various roles play into their perception of mental health. But then I actually just really stripped it down, and I could be have stripped it down too much when I think about this. The term or two words, mental health, mental. Do you think that's a word that just scares people?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a debate as to whether or not that's the, you know, should we just be talking about health? Like, you know, if you think about it, people do talk about mental and physical health, and should we just be talking about health? And in the same way that you say, well, you know, are your kidneys doing well? Is your heart doing well? Is your brain doing well? It might go a long way to kind of look at things like that. So I agree with you on that point. I think that there's something that's still kind of scary about saying, oh, there's something mentally wrong with me. You know, when people find out there's something physically wrong, there's obviously a lot of issues. You know, nobody wants to have arthritis, but they don't necessarily worry per se that they're going to be shunned because they have arthritis. They have other worries that are very significant. But it would be nice if we get to a point where those things are kind of mental and physical are talked about in the same way.
I mean, the phrase mind and body has been around for quite some time, and I don't think people have any problem using that. And most people understand that there is a major connection, of course.
Yeah, absolutely. I think people, you know, and people who would be more likely to, you know, talk about things like mind-body connection and stuff like that may be a little less likely to get concerned about these kinds of issues. But, you know, like you said, there's so many factors that lead to people having prejudice or discrimination against people with mental health issues. Sometimes it's because you've never met somebody that has an issue. Sometimes it's because you spent a lot of time with someone and you built up some kind of resentment. And so, you know, it really can happen at all points. I think the real key to preventing it is to be able to take a step back and be like, okay, hold on a second, like, you know, let me kind of try to judge someone on their behaviors and what they're doing and give them the opportunity, no matter what's going on in their head, to kind of behave in a different way. I don't have to assume that everybody that's got, you know, if we want to use the term like kind of brain issue, that they're going to behave in a way that I'm not going to like.
Dr. Michael, what are the odds, and I think they're pretty high, that individuals will experience at least once in their life a form of depression?
I think the number, the last number I read is 1 in 4.
Yeah.
I feel like it's a very high number. You know, when you're talking about what we call the major depression, where you're sad or depressed most of the day, nearly every day for at least 2 weeks, and you have other associated symptoms, that I think we're talking 1 in 4. I think, you know, being depressed as a mood is obviously something that people experience all throughout their life.
How much do we know about the brain? From what I understand, we know actually very little compared to the actual size of the brain.
Yeah, I you know, to be honest, like the kind of neuroscience is not one of my strong expertise. So there's probably
just go with it, Mike. Just go with it.
Yeah, I'm going to go with it. You know, thank you, Mark. I appreciate that. I feel validated and understood.
Absolutely.
And who knows what's going to come out of my mouth now? But you know, my sense is that we're just now starting to develop the science where we're really understanding the brain. You know, people are now saying, well, if, you know, if this behavior happens, this part of the brain lights up and this might indicate X, Y, or Z, or if you do this therapy, you see these changes. And so I think that we're starting to do a lot in terms of like kind of making connections, in terms of what happens in the brain and over behavior or reported thoughts, but we don't necessarily know what it all means yet.
Now, do you attribute this to a combination of technology and therapy and science?
I think it's mostly technology. I mean, I think that people have always been interested in the brain. I just think that, you know, it's very sophisticated to be, you know, if you look at some of the fMRI machines, it's very sophisticated to be able, you know, it's expensive. Not every university has one. If they do, they only have one, you know. So it's very different than being able to have someone come in and, like, let's fill out a self-report exam or, you know, do certain behavioral tests. So I think it's mostly just as the technology develops, we'll learn more and more.
I have to say, and I would not have said this many, many years ago when I was going through severe panic attacks. I mean, I would have to change a sheet sometimes 2-3 times a night. I would be sweating profusely. Yeah. It's just terrible. My mind would not stop racing. So I went on medication, and it freaked me out because my brother took his life when he was just on Prozac for a few weeks. Very short time. I don't even think it was enough. Not even a 30-day period for him to actually have it successfully integrate into a system. But anyway, so there's a major battle and or issue or confrontation about whether to medicate. And people, you know, the term medication just really scares people away. And I think it falls underneath the umbrella certainly of mental health. That scares them, that not knowing what's going on. Then medication that's going to make them be someone else. And that couldn't be further from the truth.
Yeah, different medications for different people have different effects.
True.
There are situations where people come to me and say that I'm not comfortable with how I'm feeling on the medication, or I don't feel myself per se. You know, so for example, there are some medications like mood stabilizers where you feel like your range of emotion feels limited in some ways. But I have not personally come across somebody who feels like they're an entirely different person because they're on medication. I mean, that from my experience, you know, working with people who have had ECT, that doesn't even happen there. If anything, what winds up happening is that it clears away some of the noise that people are experiencing so they can actually be more themselves if they're on the right medication.
And that allows you to open a door for a therapy to actually take place.
I think in some cases, yeah, when you look at the research on combined treatment, so for example, with people who have more severe chronic depression, combining medication and psychotherapy works a lot better than either treatment alone. And I think that what you just said is one of the reasons why that will occur, is that, you know, if somebody is just, their biology is such that they can't concentrate, they're not sleeping, and, you know, it's going to be so hard to attend to therapy.
Absolutely.
But then when, you know, if you take that, then it's like, oh, okay, like, I'm a little more stable now. I can start thinking about, like, you know, like the things I was saying before, like, how do I want to do enjoyable things? How do I want to connect to people? And so I think that they can work in a really synergistic way.
Hey, there's no denying when your world is turned upside down, you know, it's scary. It freaks you out. And sometimes, you know, people do anything. I understand at the smallest level, if my brother felt like 10 times what I felt, that I almost understand how people take their lives. And that took me years to be able to say that.
Yeah, it's a very tough thing when talking about suicide, obviously as a clinician, because I think you do have to walk that line where you understand why somebody would be in that mindset, yet encourage them not to do it for a variety of reasons. And I think, you know, I think one of the things that people who have suicidal ideation struggle with is that, you know, I mean, if you think people don't want to talk about mental health issues, I mean, people definitely don't want to talk about suicidal thoughts.
No.
And so, you know, you have somebody who's having those thoughts and, you know, in a lot of ways, the, you know, just kind of suppressing them and having the stigma of them without having a chance to kind of address them and figure out, well, why are you feeling like this, or the things that we can do. You know, obviously, you know, as you experienced, you know, on a personal level, it's just, it makes the whole thing that much worse.
Going back a thought or two, Mike, Dr. Mike, is something I think that's very important for people to know, and I realize as well, experience as well, is that sometimes when you're in therapy, things are going along great, but sometimes you take a step or two back, because sometimes in order to heal, you have to maybe experience something that's unpleasant. Maybe that's true all the times, maybe it's not, but sometimes it's not uncommon, I should say.
I think that, to be honest, is the recipe for most therapies. I mean, you know, what the science of anxiety is that you effectively have to experience it and tolerate. I mean, in the way that some people describe it, it's sort of like a wave, like no matter how high it gets, it eventually has to hit the beach and go down. And so, you know, when you're talking about something like panic, the treatment for panic is progressively, you know, experiencing that kind of anxiety to the point where you habituate to it, and then you kind of experience a little bit more. And so, yeah, I mean, what you're describing as two steps back is actually moving full steam ahead in therapy. Just the problem that sometimes happens is that if you don't do it in a careful, methodical way, all of a sudden, you know, someone is just is overwhelmed by it and you want to retreat from it. And so that's where, you know, a good therapist hopefully will help you, you know, kind of modulate that so that you can experience it enough to feel better, but not so much so that you're overwhelmed and maybe don't even want to do treatment anymore.
Mm-hmm. Now, it's commonplace how we keep diabetes at bay, keep a relationship healthy. How does one stay mentally healthy in terms of, now we're talking about memory, aging, et cetera. We're just talking about being mentally fill in the word for me. I'm not sure what to say.
Well, no, I think you're talking about there's a whole area. It's called positive psychology, where
I like that.
Marty Seligman, who's my undergraduate advisor, had developed 20 years ago. He basically said, "Look, we've all spent so much time talking about how to manage the negative parts of well-being. You know, how do we actually help people thrive in some ways?" And so, one of the things that I'll say to people is that it's like anything else. I mean, you really have to. For me, it starts a lot with the physical. Again, you know, repeating like the sleeping, the eating, the exercise, keeping your substances down, doing things that really make you feel better about your life. And I think what then also happens is, you know, everything when it comes to mental, you know, coping is sort of understanding and acting, you know, sort of understanding what is it that's bothering me and what's my best action forward. And what I say to people is that if you're practicing that, like, okay, I'm feeling anxious, like, what's going on? Okay, I get it now. Here's my options. You know, here are my options, and let me pick one and see which one works. And if you're doing that over the course of your life, you'll figure out what are the things that tend to trigger you and what are the ways to feel better. And so, you know, it's kind of like anything else. You put the time in, you put the effort in. You can't guarantee that you're never going to feel badly, and certainly if you have, you know, some kind of biological issue, it doesn't mean that that'll never come back. You know, it doesn't mean you're not going to have an episode of you know, like a manic episode, but it will certainly help overall. And I think that for a lot of people, it will just kind of keep them where they want to be from a mental health perspective.
And also in conjunction with months like Mental Health Awareness Month, where there's more dialogue, more in the media, more people coming forward, and more advances. I mean, with all these things coupled together, hopefully, and you know, in a not too near future, that, you know, we can minimize what people have to suffer and endure.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you hit it right on the head. And I'm hoping, you know, like with things like mental health awareness, that this just keeps happening. It keeps growing. More and more people know about it, and you know, people wind up getting better.
Dr. Mike Friedman, that's Friedman. What's your website?
It's michaelfriedmanphd.com.
Thank you so much for your time and for all your great work.
Thanks, Mark. I appreciate it.
You get it. Have a great day.
Take care.
This is Insight on PRN. My name is Mark Farrell, and that's part of Mental Health Awareness Month. And I've been getting a lot of emails saying, you know, how did you get into becoming a speaker? Not on radio, but speaking to audiences nationally about overcoming adversity, drugs and alcohol, mental health. And it comes down to this, you know, I always wanted to kind of share my problems and benefit people, because, I mean, what good is actually going through something that's completely and utterly shitty on every level if you can't help someone else? I mean, I don't want to get too heavy here, but I feel like, you know, every day, however small, you need to do something to impact someone's life. It could be the smallest thing, a smile, opening a door for somebody, telling somebody they don't suck. No, just kidding. Telling somebody that, you know, they look nice, whatever the case may be. But I'm a major proponent of that. And so years ago, I'd say about, 5-6 years ago, I had someone on my show, Mikey Fallon, MykeeFowlin, Dr. Mikey Fallon. And he's a speaker. He had a fair amount of adversity growing up in Middletown, New Jersey, and he speaks about that. His website's MikeyFallon.com. And he was on my show at when I was on CD 101.9 FM in New York City and 101.9 RXP, a terrestrial FM rock station. And he talks about, you know, being on tour and what he does and shares with audiences. His is more about racial identity or prejudices, stigmas, again, a different avenue than what I share. And then after we met like 2 or 3 times, I said to him, "Hey, Mikey, you know, we get along great. He's a really good guy. He likes sports, weightlifting, gym. We have a lot of things in common, and certainly helping people. That's a major bond we have." I said to him, "This is what I've been thinking about, you know, here's what I've experienced in life. You know, my brother took his life. My father had Alzheimer's. I was certainly borderline alcoholic, used a lot of drugs, and so on and so on and so on. Do I have enough material here to benefit people in life? He goes, absolutely, Mark. So that's how I kind of got into it. So hopefully I answered some of your questions out there. You know, it's a great thing I started 2 years ago, and I really wouldn't want to do anything besides, you know, talking on the radio, internet, and speaking live to audiences nationally. If you'd like to have me at your school, I actually do kindergarten through eighth grade, high school, college, and corporate. Log on to my website, markfarrellmotivation.com. That's M-A-R-K. Farrell, F as in Frank, A-R-R-E-L-L, motivation.com. All my pleasure, as always, every Thursday. Special thanks to all the great guys around here, the behind-the-scenes stars, Jason, Giselle, Casey, Gary Knowles next. This is PRN.FM. My name is Mark Farrell. Insight will be again here next Thursday. As I look forward to it, have a great Thursday, Friday, and a super weekend. Cheers, my friends.